Today, 2 hours of news, current affairs, and opinion, brought to you by Beyond Beijing. With in-depth panel discussions on domestic and global issues, Today brings you the story behind the headlines. Locally produced, but with a distinctly international flavor. Today.
Welcome to Today on Beyond Beijing, 2 hours of news and opinion. I'm Thomas Rippey in Beijing.
I'm Xu Qinduo. Governments around the world have spent heavily on stimulus to get out of the last financial crisis, leaving them vulnerable to the next crisis. In the first hour of our show today, we'll discuss whether the world can afford another crisis.
In the second hour, a 21-year-old music student in northwestern China has stabbed to death a young mother after he hit her with his car and saw the woman trying to record his license plate number. Find out what people are saying about the case online in the second hour of today's edition of Online Unleashed. Public debt levels in developed countries are high and continue to rise. Europe continues to struggle with sovereign debt crisis, and Japan has the highest government debt level in the world and now has to pay for the cleanup of the earthquake and tsunami. Political turmoil continues to spread across the Middle East, and oil and food prices continue to rise. Can the world's richest countries afford to bail out of yet another crisis? Joining us today to discuss this, we have in the studio Dr. Zhao Changhui, who's a senior analyst at China Exim Bank. On the phone, we have Uri Dadush, who is a senior associate and director of the International Economics Program at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, and Stephen Joski, who's the director of Access China at the Economist Intelligence Unit. Gentlemen, thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
So as we just mentioned, there's this whole sort of confluence of factors coming in here. The governments are already, a lot of the governments that have been sort of major contributors to dealing with any kind of international crisis are already really strapped for cash, in some cases very strapped for cash. And we have things out there. We have some people saying another financial crisis is imminent. We have rising oil and food prices. With natural disaster in Japan, all these things happening. And it seems increasingly likely that we're getting to a point where countries are just not going to be able to afford to fix some of these problems. Let's start with Uri. How dire is the situation? Are governments really getting to the point where they're just not going to be able to keep up with the demands being placed on them?
Well, the advanced countries are in a very different place than the developing countries. The developing countries, by and large, are in much better fiscal shape. The advanced countries, with very few exceptions, have debt levels which are way too high, which need to be reduced. And together with that, they also have very large government deficits. So there is no question that their room for maneuver is much, much less than it was 2 or 3 years ago. And finally, I will add that the long-term trends are not encouraging either because in many of these countries, particularly in the European countries, several of the European countries and Japan, the aging of the population is going to put even greater pressure on budgets and debt levels.
Okay, so Stephen, if we look at it and we say that, it's the developed countries that have these budget issues, and the developing countries like China, for example, don't necessarily have that same problem. But when you look at a major international crisis, like, say, for example, the tsunami that hit Sumatra a couple of years ago, it's mostly those developed economies that are contributing to the relief efforts. Are countries like, say, for example, China, India, Brazil, and Russia likely to or able to pick up the slack given their own needs as they continue to develop?
Yeah, I think it's inevitable that global aid flows will be under pressure at the margin going ahead. I think, as Uri was saying, the current problems with the origin of the fiscal crisis, before the global downturn, there's already a clear problem that the European-style welfare state, combined with rapidly aging demographics, just wasn't fiscally sustainable. And what the global crisis has done is sort of brought forward the day of reckoning. But at the end of the day, spending will have to be restrained if you've got a declining revenue base.
Okay. Zhang Hui, are you ready?
Yeah, sure.
So what's your sort of evaluation of the situation? If we look at sort of the risk level around the world and the ability of the international community to sort of spend the money necessary to deal with yet another crisis, and even some of the crises that are already out there, trying to bail out, for example, Portugal, or cope with rising oil prices as we see, you know, the turmoil in the Middle East. Are the resources available to sort of do this, or are we looking at a situation where some of those developed economies in particular are extremely vulnerable right now?
Oh, that's absolutely true. But the first thing here, we look at these sort of disasters, be it natural, human-made, or whatever. We can see that the resources that can be utilized by many countries, particularly those wealthy nations, have been in uncertainty or shrinking in a certain way, because countries in the group of wealthy nations in Europe have been haunted by the sort of debt crisis and also the euro crisis. Now countries like Canada, Australia, traditionally, they play a minor role in mobilizing their resources in fixing up these sort of disasters in other areas or other parts of the world. And then countries like the United States or the other largest, like Japan, are actually mired by different dilemmas. For the United States, it has been deeply mired by the two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and therefore it actually has fewer resources to mobilize. For Japan, that's another story. So for the second reason, we can see the world has never, ever short of disasters. And in case another one is coming, I guess the whole human mankind would sooner or later manage to get that over, but with greater efforts and possibly also with more unprepared sort of a state of mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a minute to take a look at this current crisis, especially the financial constraints. The IMF estimates in the paper recently that five countries, Japan, Greece, Italy, Portugal, and Iceland, have already reached their limit. Well, we have seen Greece and Ireland being bailed out in the European continent, and also Portugal probably is on the way to be bailed out. So what about the financial conditions? How do you describe the financial conditions of Japan, Italy, Uri?
Well, both Japan and Italy are clearly, very much among the most indebted countries in the world. Japanese gross debt is somewhere above 200% of GDP. However, when you take out its foreign currency reserves and also the debt that public organizations in Japan hold, government debt owned, held by other government organizations, when you take that out, still Japan has a net debt to GDP of about 120, 125% of GDP. And Italy is sort of a little above 100% net debt as a share of GDP. These are very high numbers. Furthermore, both countries are seeing very slow long-term growth. If you look at both Japan and Italy over the last 10 years, Japan even longer, there's been relatively little growth. When you have a lot of debt, and there's very little growth, you've got a problem because, you have to pay the interest on the debt. and the interest on the debt is very high in the case of Italy, much less high in the case of Japan. While I don't see either Italy or Japan immediately at risk, because these are two countries that have very large deficits at the moment and also have the worst aging problem, just about the worst aging problem among the industrial countries, I am quite pessimistic about the long-term position of both of these countries.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Stephen, we are not immediately at risk. And how much a problem do the two countries represent?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that because these problems aren't new and they are being financed by more debt, and also they've got very high private savings rates to help finance it. The governments aren't about to go broke. You know, that's effectively what will happen is just eventually they'll have to restrain spending. But I think the key point is that going ahead, you know, they just aren't the growth sources, and that there'll be some relative decline in those countries. But if you're looking at the current debt crisis, you know, we talk about Portugal and Greece, etc. I think the key thing is that those are small countries and they don't really threaten the Eurozone. But if it gets to Spain or Italy, then you would look at some potential serious financial disruption. So I think the key thing to look for is probably not so much long-term sustainability of the debt of, say, Italy or Spain, but just whether they're going to get into short-term financing problems that would threaten the euro as a mechanism, because if the euro did break up, we'd get all sorts of repercussions globally.
Mm-hmm. So these countries actually probably, you know, there's a tendency or possibility that they themselves could be, you know, the origin of the next crisis, or at least probably they will not be able to help others if there's a crisis, new crisis.
Yeah.
Dr. John.
Yeah, absolutely. If I can see over the horizon which particular sort of a crisis that are looming over, let's say, the foreseeable future. The biggest crisis that I can foresee is the debt crisis that now reaching countries in Europe and countries like Japan. Maybe a little bit surprising for many people that a country as wealthy as Japan can actually be in such a dire situation of public debt. But here we can see, yes, the debt ratio is very high, but the structure is actually basically highly built up on the private debt. That's to say, the Japanese government is in the debt, but that debt mainly is owed to the Japanese people. And therefore, that's a different thing. If we look at one of the key indicators, the current account balance versus the GDP ratio, Japan is still among the highest in the developed nations, and that is why Japan can just keep on what it is now. But on the other hand, the sort of crisis stemming from public debt that really haunted in some of the Western European nations can be really a big issue. Now, if that cannot be contained, then I think the world, not only the world economy, is really confronting another biggish issue that is coming along.
And that could be the next crisis. Okay, we'll get back into that right after this short break.
The The case of a hit-and-run killer has sparked public debate in China. One side is calling for the death penalty, the other is pleading for a lighter sentence. Join us in Online Unleashed in the second hour to hear what Chinese internet users are saying about the case.
You're listening to Today on Beyond Beijing, 2 hours of news and opinion. I'm Thomas Rippey in Beijing. Stay with us for that discussion next hour. We're going to talk about sort of reactions and responses to this hit-and-run case. It's a tragic case, but I think the way that people are responding to it is really interesting, and how on one side you have people really calling for a harsh punishment of this kid, and other side calling for mercy. So we'll get into that next hour. Right now we're talking about global preparedness for the next big crisis, whether it's a financial crisis, political crisis, natural disaster, what have you. Can the countries that have generally been able to step in and try to deal with those crises, can they still afford to do so given the budgetary problems that a lot of those countries are having? Joining us today to discuss that, we have in the studio Dr. Zhao Changhui, who's a senior analyst at China Exim Bank. On the phone, we have Uri Dadush, who is the senior associate and director of the International Economics Program from the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. And on the other line, we have Stephen Joski, who's the director for Access China at the Economist Intelligence Unit. So, Stephen, just before the break, we were talking about Japan and some of the problems it's having. And, of course, one of the big questions is, with the high level of debt that it has, even if that debt might be, I mean, relatively manageable, given that a lot of it's owed to its own people, are they going to be able to really recover from this natural disaster that really just won't stop, because the nuclear issue is ongoing? It's very hard to start even trying to recover without getting that situation sorted out. And then you've also got, as Uri mentioned earlier, the demographics in Japan don't really favor recovery because it's a very old population. So if Japan is unable to do this and really pull itself back up, does the global economy and the global community kind of lose an important pillar that's allowed it to try to deal with some of the crises that it's faced?
I wouldn't want to be too alarmist about the effect of the natural disaster on the Japanese economy. Obviously, there will be no noticeable effect on GDP this year, and it'll be negative, but it'll probably be much, much less than the effect of the global financial crisis, to put it in context, you know, far less than 1 percentage point of GDP growth, because most of the impact occurs in a very short space of time. You know, Japan still has quite a competitive high-tech export sector, and that should, obviously, demand for that is still strong, and that should recover quickly through the year, and plus there'll be a stimulus to the Japanese economy from the construction rebuild, which will occur quite quickly. It will be financed by debt, but in the short to medium term, I don't think we're looking at sort of a major economic dislocation from the natural disaster itself.
Okay, so in your sense then, Japan will eventually recover and will be able to still be an important player in sort of mitigating any global crisis, because it has in the past been a relatively stable donor when things have come up, and you think they'll still be able to play that role?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the economy isn't finished. I mean, they're looking more at very, very subdued growth going ahead, just as they've been experiencing for the last much more than the last decade. So there's really no dramatic change to the outlook there.
Okay. Uri, I wanted to ask you another question, too, about, you mentioned the importance of demographics, and some of the countries that are facing these debt issues are just, they're getting older, which makes it harder. I mean, you have a smaller tax base because you have fewer people working because they're all retired. Is that demographic shift going to be one of the key things to look for as we look at which countries are able to really respond to a crisis?
Yeah, it's a key global challenge. It's particularly interesting that, you know, Japan is sort of feeling the effects of it earlier than some other countries, but obviously it's affecting China here as well. And virtually every major economy, and the only economies that aren't really being affected by it are particularly the Middle Eastern countries with very rapidly growing populations, but they've actually got an opposite problem in the sense that the very large youth populations combined with economic underperformance producing massive political instability. So in some ways the solution's not easy, because it's more or less just a fact that countries have to adapt to. So I think everyone's looking to Japan to see how its model of adapting to low demographic growth or negative demographics it's already into will occur. And it's not an easy issue or one on which the jury's still out in some ways. But I think some of the doomsday scenarios about demographic decline are exaggerated because they're also offsetting savings from a shrinking population. Obviously, you have to spend less money on the young population. And as I said, there tends to be a much more stable environment, which can be good and bad. I mean, it's stable politically, but it can also mean a less dynamic economy with less innovation.
Stable, but maybe also stagnant.
Yeah.
Okay, Udi, what's your sense? How these doomsday scenarios that people have talked about with demographic decline that Stephen was just mentioning, are you one of the doomsayers, or do you think it's not as bad as some people are saying?
Well, I tend to agree with Stephen that it's certainly an issue, and it's a very different issue in different countries. I mean, as I said, Italy and Japan, Germany have a very rapid aging problem. On the other hand, the United States and the UK also have an aging problem, but it's much less pronounced, partly because of immigration in the United States and partly just the demographic composition of the labor force. In the United States, the problem is made very significantly worse by the fact that healthcare costs are already a very large part of GDP. It's about 15% of GDP is healthcare costs in the United States, and these costs are going up. The inflation of those costs is extremely high. And so the combination, even though the aging trend is not as pronounced as in many other countries, advanced countries, the healthcare costs alone are likely to add enormously to the budget burden in the course of the next 20, 30 years. However, as I think Steve is suggesting, the doomsday scenarios are probably not justified, in part because people tend to extrapolate these trends and assume that the economy just stays exactly the same as it is. But in fact, economies adapt, markets adapt. So if there are more older people and there are less workers, you will see people retire later. There'll be very strong incentives for people to retire later. You will also see technology evolve in a way that makes the workers more productive and finds ways of caring for people in a more efficient way. Also, economies can adapt by allowing greater immigration of younger people that can look after the older people. And there are many, many other ways in which prices and wages adjust, and eventually government policy is also forced to change. But there's no question that what we're talking about is a major economic and policy adaptation, which has to happen in order to grapple with this problem, and that one of the implications will be that if nothing is done, the budget deficits and the debt levels are simply going to spin out of control.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have been talking about like the financial troubles that some countries are stuck in, and also like probably the lack of preparedness. But if we look at the possible next crisis, you know, to get prepared for that crisis, when it comes to like a crisis preparedness, Dr. Zhou, you know, financial policy, sound and strong financial policy, probably is that the only focus?
Necessarily, that's important, but really. One single factor can never be regarded as the causes of the disasters these days, because I think our world has been entering a very complicated and little multi-dimensional sort of disastrous stages. In a certain way, we can see crises like you know, what we have right now, even in Japan, can be at least threefold. The quake, tsunami, followed very briefly by the crisis of the nuclear stations. And that's to say, any crisis staging in any place can be a multidimensional factors. Now, if we think we can be better prepared for the next disaster that is coming along, I guess for the man-made, let's say, disasters, we got to have much better policies. Now, basically, in the macro economic policy, that is probably, to me, the single most important one. If a country is really progressing to a certain extent, and then all of a sudden it can just dip into big troubles simply because the macro policies and therefore strategies based on all these policies are really bad. So eventually that will bite. Now, things like this can be prevented to a certain extent or to a certain degree. But again, we got to have the sort of political will to carry out through. We can think something up, think it through, and then try to map out the best possible scenarios and the best possible ways to deter all these crises. But eventually, let me just say, crisis is a sort of phenomenon that's really in line with the progress the human mankind is really progressing.
Mm-hmm. Well, natural crises are probably very, very much unpredictable. But for man-made problems, man-made disasters, for example, like rising food prices, you know, contributed to the uprising in Tunisia and Egypt. So, can we do anything? Is there anything we can do as a government? I mean, to deal with a looming like food crisis, Stephen?
Yeah. Well, The world certainly produces enough food for everyone. It's more a question of distribution and access to income. And quite often a lot of the worst food problems occur in countries just that are over-regulated, and that creates poverty. So once again, I think you get back to one of the fundamental lessons of economics is that governments really do need to focus on fundamental economic reform to sort out these problems in the long run. You know, obviously with the financial crisis fresh in everyone's memories, there's a lot of talk about financial re-regulation and making the financial system a bit more robust. But it's really important that governments don't lose sight of the need for really fundamental liberalisations of markets to raise living standards.
Mm-hmm. Uri, so the reform on the fundamental economic basis?
So you're asking me about food crisis?
Yeah, food crisis, yeah, and also, yes, like how to, you know, get better prepared for that.
Yes. Well, I agree, you know, the world is not running out of food. There's plenty of food. But there is an issue of the way markets are working. And there is, of course, the issue of poverty. People don't have enough income to buy food. And the poverty issue is a much deeper issue. That's about development. That's a very long conversation. The issue of food price volatility and why we have these huge surges in food prices and then declines and then surges again, and we have relatively recently, have become more pronounced, do have quite a lot to do with bad government policies. The first bad government policy has to do with the whole agricultural regime in the world and trade policies. So you know that agriculture is today, continues to be one of the most, the most protected and subsidized sector of world trade, very different than manufacturers, which has been liberalized over a long period. The fact that agricultural markets are highly segmented and protected means that a shock will tend to hit different countries in very different ways, and particularly the developing countries suffer from the fact that that markets, agricultural markets in the advanced countries are subsidized in a way to mitigate the effect of prices. Prices, in a sense, are controlled in various ways, which means that the volatility spills over onto international markets and affects particularly developing countries. The other way in which trade policies add to the volatility is because countries feel insecure in their food supply and their ability to access international markets. And so therefore, when there is a large increase in prices, they tend to try and keep the food at home. They put on export restrictions. This, of course, makes everybody panic outside. Finally, the other way in which government policies are greatly adding to the problems is the increasing use of corn and sugar, but corn is particularly important for the production of biofuels. Essentially, we're using a very large part of the world's corn output now to produce energy, to produce gasoline, instead of allowing it for food. Now, this would be fine if it actually reflected market realities, but to a large degree, particularly in the United States, that especially is a problem in the United States, to a large degree, this is actually artificial. I mean, it's the reflection of subsidies and tariffs on and various mandates that make it profitable to use corn to make gasoline in the end, or fuel instead of for food. So agricultural policies, trade policies, and biofuel policies together are greatly adding to the problem, and all of those could be changed. We know what has to be done. It's just that politically, it's very difficult to do.
Okay. One last question before we go to our next break. For Stephen here. One thing that it looks to me like you've got, so the food prices are one issue, but those are, of course, being affected by now. We have rising oil prices, which affect transport costs, which means your food costs are going up again. And there's sort of a negative feedback loop here where things, one thing affects the other and sort of just continues to lead into a more difficult situation for the global economy, because now with all these rising prices and inflation, then it makes it harder for some of the countries that are in the middle of a recovery to continue on with that economic recovery. And it seems to me that there's a sort of building confluence of factors that could lead to another crisis. And so I wonder if, you know, if we look at the last major global crisis, which was the financial crisis, it's sort of viewed as being more or less, I mean, obviously it's never this easy, but a sort of a single cause crisis where there was a financial meltdown in certain markets, and that sort of caused a collapse of the international economic system. But are we looking now at a situation where the next crisis might just sort of be a confluence of many different factors, and that that might be, because of the sort of more complicated nature of it, be it that much harder to deal with?
Yeah, I mean, oil prices are definitely a major risk. Even though there were some very strong, you know, financial drivers of the crisis in 2008-2009, it's very clear that oil prices in around that period were extremely high, and even more worrying that virtually every, almost every major recession, you know, going back 50 years, has been preceded by spikes in oil prices. If you look at it objectively, you know, the global economy is becoming less dependent on oil, and people are getting richer, and that, you know, a smaller part of their incomes is being spent on oil. But there's no doubt it's certainly got a very strong association with recession. So I think maybe the word crisis maybe a little bit strong, given we've just experienced a fairly severe one a couple of years ago. But it certainly does increase the risk of an economic downturn with high oil prices.
Okay, on that, we're going to take one more short break. We'll be back with more on global crisis preparedness right after this.
The case of a hit-and-run killer has sparked public debate in China. One side is calling for the death penalty, the other is pleading for a lighter sentence. Join us in Online Unleashed in the second hour to hear what Chinese internet users are saying about the case.
You're listening to Today on Beyond Beijing, 2 hours of news and opinion. I'm Thomas Rippey in Beijing. We're talking today about the next global crisis and whether or not the world is prepared to handle it, given all the expenditures they've had to undertake to deal with previous crises. We have in the studio Dr. Zhao Changhui, who's a senior analyst at China Exim Bank. On the phone, we have Udi Dadush, who is the Senior Associate and Director at the International Economics Program at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. And on the other phone line, we have Stephen Joski, who is the Director of Access China at the Economist Intelligence Unit. So let's look now at sort of expectations. I think we've gotten to a point now where people just sort of expect that their governments, or even in some cases other people's governments, other, you know, a global community will step in and sort of help and deal with the next crisis. But so, Changhui, has it always been that way? Have governments always been the ones that were there to step in and deal with these things? Or have we become more dependent on government action to deal with crises than we maybe used to be?
Very difficult. Because by nature, a government is actually formed by, let's say, a kind of social contract that the group or the community or the whole society is willingly to be governed by their representative. The representative is the government. Now, because of the Westphalian sort of a state, still the basic fact of life for the international community, and therefore the government in any country is by far the most pervasive in terms of public resources, and also it has the sole power over many things, foreign policies, of course, taxes, yes. Violence, yes, and a group of many others. And that's why a government got to be responsible for at least any disastrous or any other sort of major crisis happening within its borders. Because within the border, people in many other sectors, public or the private sector, simply cannot mobilize a necessary large enough resource to guard against the disasters and crises. Now, if we look beyond the national border, then in other countries, in all the countries, it's governed by an individual state or government. So every government is only authorized and therefore legal within its own border. Even, let's say, international community, by the representative of the United Nations, it cannot just say a certain country can do this or that, because that is the legal accountability of an independent nation. Now, this said, we do have the sort of responsibilities that governments collectively can shoulder up. For instance, natural disasters. If a natural disaster happened somewhere, automatically, that is something stepping up the sort of humanitarian responsibility at least. And then it is also out of the deep, remote sort of human heart feelings that we people tend to help those in the weak position. And therefore, now this sort of alignment can also help a lot. But on the whole, governments are really independent. It's just like independent nations.
Okay. So, Udi, what's your sense? Are governments now, have we become overly dependent on governments to be able to deal with these crises? Has it always been that way?
Well, no. I mean, it hasn't always been that way, in that governments used to be a tiny part of the economy, the huge tax bases and large-scale expenditure, social safety nets, etc., are relatively recent phenomena in human history. I would venture a guess, I don't have the number in my head, but I would venture a guess that, say, 150 years ago, or 200 years ago, before the welfare state was even on the horizon, government share in output must have been a small fraction of what it is today. So governments are just much more important than they used to be. And especially so in the advanced countries where, the tax share in GDP, the expenditure share in GDP, is over half, for example, in several of the Scandinavian countries. Now there is a logic here that because the government is such a huge part of the economy, in a sense it is able to offer insurance. It is able to insure itself provide insurance to the rest of the population because of its size in the event of disasters. And that is in effect what happens. There are alternatives to government, of course. You can actually buy private insurance, and in fact private insurers will pay for some significant part of the Japanese earthquake. Certainly not the biggest part, but some significant chunk will be paid by private insurance and reinsurance companies. And historically, and even today, of course, people fall back on their families and close relatives and friends at a time of trouble. But the government is now a huge part of the economy, and it is through the welfare state providing insurance in many respects, including natural disasters and, as we saw during the financial crisis, and thank God we had that, because the interventions of the government through the bank rescues and also the various elements of fiscal stimulus and monetary stimulus, which happened also in a big way in China, helped avoid a catastrophe.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, speak of this, the role government plays in disaster relief efforts. Stephen, what responsibility should the governments have in dealing with natural or, you know, economic disasters within or beyond national borders?
It's really just a question of capacity and willingness to assist. I mean, obviously, with small countries with major disasters, they often can't cope. And the bigger countries, particularly with bigger military forces, are often very well positioned to provide very, very rapid emergency assistance. But there are obviously different degrees of assistance. You know, does the government step in to cover people who didn't bother to insure? And do you provide long-term ongoing aid after that? So there's not a simple answer to all this. And in many ways, I think probably the basic principle is that governments are very well equipped for really rapid response, and it's quite appropriate for that to be international, given some countries are richer than others. But in terms of the longer the follow-up assistance, it becomes much more difficult to say whether it's worthwhile. You know, it's just a broader question of what's an effective form of international development. You know, on the one hand, we've had Africa, which has received billions of dollars in foreign aid and doesn't have a lot to show for it, and then you've had China, which has received very little government foreign aid and has obviously grown very strongly.
Mm-hmm. Like if you look at like the countries like the United States and the European countries, you know, the government played a role in, say, bailing out the banking system or some of the even sovereign nations like Greece and Ireland. So what do you think the government played a proper role in dealing with that the last financial crisis?
Yeah, I think it's clear that the financial system isn't a normal market, and when it dysfunctions, there's very rapid problems for the rest of the economy, and governments, given that they create the money that underpins this, they have to step in quickly to stabilise things to prevent the collapse of the system. But it becomes, I think the debate, particularly in the US now, is quite interesting, because the question is how does the process stop? You know, Do you keep printing money as long as its growth is below some target or not? Because obviously there's a cost to it in terms of increased debt.
Mm-hmm. Uri, like as Western governments, the rich nations, now under pressure, you know, huge pressure for like a budget problem or the financial issues, so will they be less likely to offer, say, international assistance? Uri?
So far, I think there's relatively little evidence that aid has been affected. I'm talking about ordinary development aid. There's been, some decline in countries that are really in terrible trouble, like Italy or Spain. But by and large, aid levels have remained quite high, actually, during the crisis. This is partly because aid is a very small part of the expenditure and the GDP of the advanced countries. I mean, most advanced countries give less than 0.5% of GDP to aid annually, countries are very aware in very difficult times, as we had during the financial crisis, that very poor people are in terrible trouble. So they tend not to, if they can, cut that kind of expenditure during tough times. Aid and assistance, including humanitarian assistance and assistance for tragedies like the Japanese earthquake, are actually a very, very small part of the expenditure picture for countries. And for these reasons, I don't think the effects of the rising debt levels and the deficits on these kinds of operations will be huge. They'll make it a little bit more more difficult. I think the effects of the high debts and high deficits spill over onto much more important areas. For example, in the United States, individual states are having to cut spending on education, and they're having to fire teachers, and they are having to fire government employees and reduce, you know, all sorts of government operations. These are, in fact, the big items of expenditure on the budget, and those are the items that are getting hit the most.
So just to kind of summarize, what it sounds like is, well, some of the natural disasters, like what happened in Japan, or earthquakes, floods in Pakistan that we've seen previously, or the tsunami in Sumatra, while these things are tragic and they look awful, and they I think generate a lot of sympathy and interest because the television images are so striking, and because you can look at that and you understand very quickly what the problem is, but the actual money that it costs to sort of deal with these things is relatively small compared to what it costs to bail a nation out of a financial crisis we've seen in the past. So then again, what you're saying is that even if countries have rising debt levels, they'll be able to deal with the sort of natural disaster type crises, but it's the financial crises that are really the major concern.
Just to give you a sense of magnitude, it is estimated that the Japanese earthquake may cost Japan at most 4% of GDP, probably less. In Ireland, the banking crisis is estimated to cost more than 50% of GDP.
Okay, so this is the real issue. sorry, Stephen, were you going to add something?
No, that's fine. Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, so then when we look at this next financial crisis, let's take the last minute or two that we've got here, and I'm going to put Dr. Zhao on the spot one last time. We've seen some economists coming out and saying that the next financial crisis could be imminent, that we might be looking at this happening relatively soon. If another financial crisis does happen, and given that a lot of the governments already have these high debt levels, and that the financial crises we just talked about with Udi are so much more expensive than natural disasters, if that financial crisis were to happen again, are we going to look at a much longer period of recovery, given that a lot of governments just don't have the money right now to spend on the stimulus that they spent after the last financial crisis?
You can bet. Yes, I think that disorder will be lasting maybe for, you know, one generation or even two generations, and simply because the disasters of that way, it can cause the major developed nations, either those in Western Europe or North America or Australia or whatever, in the collective sort of failure in their economy in terms of the budget and the public debt versus GDP, no current account, no trade, investment, all over. So that's to say, if another financial crisis does come again, I think that's really, a nice age for this generation and beyond.
Wow. All right. Very serious. So that's going to wrap up our discussion. We want to thank our guest, Dr. Zhao Changhui at China Exim Bank, Rudy Dadush at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, and Stephen Joski from the Economist Intelligence Unit. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about what might be a technology bubble again forming in the United States, and coming up next, the Hourly News.